We have been studying a little bit on the seven churches of Revelation 2 and 3. So if you'll turn to Revelation 2, 8 to 11 for our study today, I've entitled it Firm in the Faith, and it goes along a little bit with what has been said and read in our service today. Let's look at it's Revelation 2, verses 8 to 11. And unto the angel, you remember Jesus appeared to John as a high priest walking among the candlesticks or the candelabra on the earth, and each one represents a church, or it also represents a segment of church history. And so the second one, we looked at Ephesus last week, the second one reads this way, and unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. That's Christ speaking. I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that ye may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. Now, as we go through a little study here, we're looking at both the local church, what we know about the local church, and then of the church age that is symbolized here. In John's day, the city of Smyrna was just 40 miles north of Ephesus. If you start out, as we said, on the Imperial Post Road, the mailing system of that day, and would go around, follow the road through Asia Minor, these churches are all in sequence. And Smyrna is the next one, 40 miles north of Ephesus. If Ephesus symbolizes the apostolic age, which we believe it does, and that's, say, from A.D. 31 when Jesus went to heaven to the end of the century when John died. John probably died around 100 or 95. We know he was in prison, on the Patmos in 95. Then the Smyrna church, as a division of church history, runs from about 100 A.D. to 323, generally where we put it, where Constantine the Great took over the empire. You have a couple centuries there of history in the Roman Empire, and Smyrna seems to symbolize that. It was the church of the cross. In those couple hundred centuries, the pagan Roman Empire fought with everything in its power to destroy Christianity. And you'll see it here as we go along. So sometimes we call it the Church of the Cross because of how many martyrs died under pagan persecution. We're not talking about Christian persecution that came in the Dark Ages. We're talking now about first couple hundred years after the apostles. In the early years, the Roman Empire, Roman officials usually regarded the Christians as just a variation of the Jewish religion. And the Jews were legal. When Rome would conquer a nation, they'd take a look at their religion. Some they allowed as legal and could function, and others they didn't. But the Jews were very much a favorite of Julius Caesar for some reason. And they were given legality. They didn't have to offer any incense to the emperors or even join the army. They had certain liberties. Well, the early Christians were viewed as just a variant form of Jews, that's all. And they were poor, and it didn't cause much trouble. But beginning with Trajan, the Emperor Trajan, T-R-A-J-A-N, who ruled from 98 to 117, Christianity became an illegal religion. It was defined as illegal. Nero had persecuted, but that was more of a to get the rumors off his back that he had set fire to Rome. It really wasn't an official persecution in the sense of what happened from Trajan. From Trajan on, it is Roman policy to destroy Christianity and destroy Christians. It eventually became empire-wide. Some say, well, there are 10 general persecutions. Not so really, but it comes every once in a while. It was kind of an intermittent thing. And as Christianity continued to grow, let me read you a statement here from one of the historians, because then you get the picture of the church between the closing of with John's death and the accession of Constantine the Great, who became emperor of the whole Roman Empire. This historian says it was a war of extermination waged by heathen Rome against defenseless Christianity. It was a most unequal struggle, a struggle of the sword and of the cross. Carnal power all on one side, moral power all on the other. It was a struggle for life and death. One or the other of the combatants must succumb. A compromise was impossible. Paganism recognized that Christianity claimed to be the only true religion, and that meant everything else would go. And so it was a death struggle. And the persecutions increase. I mean, as Tertullian would say, anything happened, they'd say, away, Christians to the lions. they threw them to the animals. They tortured them. They cut their heads. Everything you can think of. It was a bloody, bloody two centuries. Now, let's look at the speaker here for just a minute. And we'll look at the local situation first, and then we'll look at the universal. It's very significant that the speaker, Christ, which aspect of his picture here in Revelation 1 does he pick on? It's very significant with this local church and with the era that it represented. He identifies himself as what? These things saith the first and the last, which was what? Dead and came to life. That's very significant. It's a reference to what? What's he referring to? I was dead. On the cross. He's referring to Calvary, where the great conflict came to a head there. And it looked like, I suppose, from one side Satan had won. But he what? He came to life. That's the great resurrection. Those two great truths that he wanted this particular church to understand. He wants us to understand too. I know whereof I speak. I can understand your situation. I died. I arose again. You may die, but you too will rise again. That's the implication. I'm the first and the last. I'll have the final say in this struggle. If you keep your finger there, there's one text I like very much, Hebrews 2:9. The one who speaks to us in our needs and in our troubles, Hebrews 2:9, is one who has suffered for each one of us. Paul says in Hebrews 2:9, we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for how many? For every man, for every person. That's, I don't know how you feel about that. That makes it very personal. I like the John 3:16, for God so loved the world, but I like it better when I read a text that says he died for me. He tasted death for every one of us. And he rose for me. His resurrection is significant for each of us. Now look at some of the characteristics of the Smyrna church. First, locally, verse 9. I know thy works and what? Tribulation. I know your trials. I know your tests. For the sake of the faith. That's really what was involved. But I know your tests. And I know what else, too? What? Your poverty. The Greek word here is interesting. It's not just poverty. It's extreme poverty. It's the word used about the widow who put how much into the treasury? Yeah. Too much. I know your poverty. I know you struggle with poverty. And you can think about it even with us. We know what poverty is in some places here. And then verse 9. I know your tests, your trials, your tribulations. I know your trials. I know your poverty from hand to mouth, as it were. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. That's a peculiar expression. Who are these folks who claim that they are Jews but are not? Now, we're looking at a symbolic book, okay? Now, it's interesting. I looked at several commentaries, and they all said, these are real, live, honest-to-goodness Jews. You think so? No. You're dealing with symbolic book. I'll show you what it is. Look at Romans 2, 28, 29. I have to look a couple texts on this. Keep your finger there, but look at Romans 8. Not Romans 8. Romans 2, 28, 29. This is a concept that you've got to get from the New Testament. For he is not a Jew. Now watch. What is a true Jew in the Bible sense, in the New Testament sense? For he is not a Jew which is one outwardly. Now what's he saying there? Huh? Yeah. He is not a Jew really who is physically, by race, a Jew. Neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew, which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God. Who is a, biblically speaking, who is a Jew? Are you a Jew? Yes, you are. Yes, you are, because you are a Christian. Now watch. Look at Galatians 2, 28. Look at 28 and 29. Now watch this. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither bond nor free. There is neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Christ. And if you be Christ's, are you Christ? Do you belong to Jesus Christ? Have you been baptized in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit? Have you? Yeah. Do you belong to Christ? Come on. Yes. If you belong to Christ, verse 29, if you are Christ, then are you Abraham's what? Seed. Well, if you're Abraham's seed, what are you? You're a Jew. You are a spiritual Jew. If you be Christ, then are you Abraham's seed? And heirs according to what? To the promise. To all these promises. In other words, God never intended. Well, as he says it in some places, Romans 9, not all Israel are Israel. God gave his promises to Israel, but he gave them to the Israel of faith. And most of the Jews rejected the Messiah, but if you accept the Christ, you accept the Christ the same as Abraham accepted the Christ. And we become the seed of Abraham, and we become spiritual Jews. Actually, in biblical language, we're all spiritual Jews. A real Jew, as far as God is concerned, is not one of the flesh, he's one of the heart. And every Christian, then, is a Jew, in that sense, a spiritual Jew. So what do you have here in Revelation 2? Now, you should be able to figure this out. In the Smyrna church, There are people, he says, which say, verse 9, which say they are Jews, which say they are what? Just translated.
Christians.
Which say they are Christians, but they really are not. They belong to the synagogue, that's a Jewish term, of Satan. Okay, who are they? You should be able to figure that out. Huh?
Satan worshipers.
No, they're not Satan worshipers. No, I wouldn't call them even Pharisees. Don't make your dragon too deep. That's closer. That's right. They are false brethren. That's all. They're people that profess to be followers of Jesus, but are not really in the heart. And Paul talks about false brethren in the church. It makes it hard sometimes under pressure. Under pressure, sometimes false brethren are hard on true brethren. And so they had not only trials and poverty, but they also discovered some of those among them as they thought were good, solid members were really not solid members. They were actually false. Jesus gave it to us in a different way. He said, what grows together in the garden? The weeds and the tares. The weeds and the tares. And it's the same type of thing. Now, let's go on to the next thing. He predicts trials that are coming. Verse 10 said, fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Actually, the Greek reads, stop being afraid of those things which you are about to suffer. Now, if we're thinking about the local church, evidently something was going to happen. Stop fearing those things which thou shalt suffer. And that's a good message for us. I heard Patricia saying one time when we were going through that little book, preparing for the crisis, you weren't too happy to read that book. You didn't like to think about the future. Well, here's good counsel for us. Stop fearing the future. It's today. It's today that we have to live. We can know something about the future, but stop fearing about the future. It's today that we have to meet. Stop fearing, he says, none of those things which thou art about to suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison. And I think this is good to realize this too. In the great controversy, well, who are we dealing with? Satan and God. It's a matter of a struggle back and forth between the two great powers. And it's not God that throws us into prison. It's the devil that wants to destroy us. And God permits, because of the great controversy, the principles involved in the great controversy, sometimes he permits. Anyway, he says, stop fearing those things which you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that ye may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. Now, we don't know a whole lot about the local church. We know that there were some martyrdoms in that local church of Smyrna. One very famous one, Polycarp, if you want his name, P-O-L-Y-C-A-R-P, Polycarp. Polycarp, there's a lot of legends about Polycarp, but if you can diffuse some of the legends, he was a real person. He was the pastor of the Smyrna church, is thought, from the data given, for about 40 years. But what's interesting about Polycarp is that he knew John, the Apostle John. He wrote a letter, and we have some other information about Polycarp that seems valid, and he claims to have known John the Apostle. He lives way back there in those very, very early days. Polycarp, we do know, was martyred for his faith while he was still pastor of Smyrna. And if you tear away all the other, all the legends that have been built around it, apparently when he was quite elderly, he was arrested in one of these Roman persecutions. And one of the tests that Trajan had proposed was that if a person is arrested as a Christian, he should be made to stand before an image of the emperor and offer incense to the emperor as God and curse Christ. And we had thousands and thousands of Christians that would refuse to do it. So when Polycarp was arrested, the Roman officer presented him with this image of the emperor and asked him to offer incense and to curse Christ. And we have this record that this is his answer. 86 years have I served him, Christ, and never has he done me wrong. How then can I curse my king who saved me? That seems to have come down intact is what he actually said. 86 years have I served him and he never did me wrong. How then can I curse my king who saved me? That's a noble testimony, isn't it? Well, the crowd wanted to throw him to the lions, but apparently the lions had already been fed on some other criminal people and they were full and they didn't want to eat him. So they burned him at the stake. They burned him. That's all we know. But prophetically, now Polycarp is the only name that we know of a person that died in Smyrna. But if you take the era of from 100 to 323, there were 10 days, if you want to take it prophetically, and I think we would do it, from 303 to 313, a day equaling a year, The bloodiest of the empire persecutions took place in those 10 years under Diocletian and his associate emperors and ended with Constantine, who took over the empire. It was the bloodiest of the empire-wide persecutions. Bibles were burned. Churches that had been built in those couple hundred years were destroyed. Christians were deprived of their jobs and their civil rights. And one diabolical thing, they knew that they would not worship the emperor, so they took wine in this one area. They took wine and offered it to the gods, and then went into the marketplaces and sprinkled wine, this sacrificial wine, over all the food in the marketplace. So the Christian either had to buy the sprinkled wine and buy the sprinkled food and eat it, which they would take as worship of the god, or starve, or apostatize. What would you do? You know, this is not too far from boycott. If all the marketplaces, let's say, if all the marketplaces of Chatsworth or of this northeast Georgia were sprinkled with sacrificial wine, we'll say, and therefore, if you ate it, they would tantamount look at that as eating, as worshiping. Would you eat it? Would you refuse to eat it? Would you starve? It's going to come again. Boycott? Isn't that what it says in Revelation 13? Not able to buy or sell? Well, you have to be in their context. You have to be in their context. It's the same thing as the three men worshiping that image on the plains of Dura. They could have stooped down there and tied their sandals. But see, they know everybody's watching. And they know what the king has said. You worship that image? Or the fiery ferns. If they had, or Daniel. Daniel didn't have to pray in the open window. He could have prayed in his closet, but he knows he's on the, what shall we say, he's on the line. They're waiting for him, and he didn't want to disappoint them. Now, in the context, it is, they would take this as the worship of God or the denial of God. That's how they would look at it. And I think this is what made these people stand true. Yeah. There's no question when that time comes, if any of us are living in it, it'll be a challenge to us whether we be loyal to God or in some way try to... And there was a lot of apostasy. You can't help it. There was a lot of apostasy in this period under that type of pressure. As Shaw says, all the pains which iron and steel, fire and sword, rack and cross, wild beasts and beastly men could inflict were employed to gain the useless end. Those 10 years were the bloodiest period of the whole Roman Empire. And then Constantine won in some of his battles and took control of the empire. And in 313, he published the Edict of Toleration, which suddenly stopped the whole thing. Actually, Roman paganism collapsed, and Christianity took the field. Now, I want to just make one statement about this Edict of Toleration, 313. I didn't know this myself until I read it the other day. Constantine, we don't think of Constantine very well. We don't like him too well. Constantine really wasn't much of a Christian. He was more of a politician. And he saw that that the empire was destroying the cream of the crop, so to speak. And he wanted to keep both pagans and Christians and keep them somehow coming together. But in his edict of 313, this first proclamation of, they call it an edict of toleration, but it was more than that, actually. This was the first proclamation of the great principle that every man has a right to choose his religion according to the dictates of his own conscience and honest conviction without compulsion and interference from the government. That's the first time you had a decree that made that every man could choose his religion according to the dictates of his own conscience and not be forced by government one way or the other. A religion is worth nothing except as an act of freedom. A forced religion is no religion at all. And this is what we fear today in the religious right, the coalition of the right, and the drive of the religious right, is because we know from Bible prophecy that the day will come when church and state in this country will come sufficiently in harmony with one another that the church will tell the state what religious dicta to enforce, whether I accept it or not. Of course, after Constantine, this principle of separation of church and state, and it isn't separation of church and state, it's the principle of a right to choose your religion according to the dictates of your own conscience. That doesn't really get into actual practice till we get here to America, till not when we first come to America, but in our Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And that's why we tremble for the day when that might happen again, when state is told by church what religions, what religious things to enforce. But at that point, in 313, the principle was enunciated, and too bad they didn't follow it. Look at the promises now, chapter 2, verse 10 to 11, just quickly here. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. There's a negative and a positive here. The last part of 11, first part of 10, be thou faithful unto death, I will give thee a crown of life, a crown which is life eternal. That's the positive. And he won't be hurt of the second death. What's the second death? You can look at Revelation 20, verse 14. Revelation 20, verse 14. at the executive judgment at the end of the millennium, and death and hell, that is the grave. Death and the grave were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second, what? Death. No resurrection. That's the end. So the promise is you might lose your life. As Tertullian said, the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church. The church wasn't destroyed by Rome in those two centuries. Rome tried everything it could to destroy it and fell itself.